I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Vanessa Angelica Villarreal. She just came out with a critically acclaimed, amazing first book of poetry called Beast Meridian. And we're going to talk to her about her poetry and about coming from Texas. She's was born in Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, which, if you know the geography of Texas, is a long way from El Paso. I think it's closer and quicker to get to Los Angeles from El Paso than it is to the Rio Grande Valley. But it is a border area. And so she grew up in a somewhat similar area as we have here in El Paso. And I met her when she was passing through. She did a reading over here at Las Mujeres Obreras. And it was just amazing, and it was powerful. And I picked up her book, and I think you're going to like these poems. And this writer, she's amazing, and she's brilliant. So stick around, and we're going to talk to Vanessa Angelica Villarreal. Vanessa Angelica Villarreal was born in the Rio Grande Valley borderlands to formerly undocumented Mexican immigrants. Her work has recently appeared in Academy of American Poets Poem a Day, BuzzFeed, Epiphany, Southern Indiana Review, Apogee, Poor Claudia, PBS NewsHour, and the list goes on and on. She is author of this collection we're going to talk about, Beast Meridian, and is currently pursuing her doctorate in English Literature and Creative Writing at the University of Southern California. Vanessa, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
Oh, this is just such an amazing book. And we're going to, you know, dig into this book a little bit more deeply later on. But just so our listeners can get an introduction to you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I was born in McAllen, Texas. And McAllen, Texas is about 3 to 5 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border.
Right.
It's kind of a sister city with Reynosa. And I grew up, you know, all around the Rio Grande Valley area. And at 5 years old, we moved to Houston. And Houston is a very different city, very
right.
metropolitan. And it has a completely different cultural, demographic, racial makeup. And so, I'm Tejana through and through in a lot of different ways. You know, I have a history in the borderlands and a history in Houston, which is an extremely diverse city.
Right,
it's the most diverse city in the world. And so I'm very proud of my roots. And I went to the University of Houston. It took me 11 years to get through my bachelor's degree.
That sounds like me.
Yeah, I was a non-traditional student.
Right.
I expected to do the whole like 4 years thing, but you know, when you come from like a working class background, it just doesn't work out that way. And I had to work a lot and
right.
take classes at, you know, community colleges. But I finally made it through, and I didn't expect to come out of it with a creative writing degree. But, you know, here we are.
So you left the Rio Grande Valley, which is, of course, you know, one of the literary locations that from which Latinx literature had, you know, comes from, continues to come from, and has traditionally come from. You left when mm-hmm. you were 5 years old, but I'm wondering, do you still have some sort of soul or spiritual memory of it that you think lingers within you?
Absolutely. So I still have family that lives there.
Oh, so you go back.
Yeah, I went back after my son was born. He was about one. And, I don't go as often as I would like, but my uncle still lives there. All of my family from Mexico still lives there. But it's funny that you say like a spiritual memory, because that's actually kind of the memory that I have of the place to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the valley has this sort of spiritual, almost haunted quality to it. And I think it has something to do with it being so close to the coast, you know, that
uh-huh.
that colonial encounter,
yeah.
you know, and I think that it also being so close to the border, it's just a place that has like psychic imprints of, you know, violence, but also resilience and also joy and family. And so, you know, when I think of the valley, it's just, it feels like home still.
Right.
And I think of like that particular Valley Spanish and the Valley Spanglish, like guachale and like, you know, things like that, that are just like so dear to me. And they're so recognizable to me when I hear them. And so I always just feel so welcome when I go back.
Yeah, I don't know that area very well. I'm from Fresno, California, and I've been living in El Paso for many years now. And I've only been to the Rio Grande Valley once for a reading. But yeah, you feel something there. And there's certain, I think, you know, when we travel, and I know you travel a lot now that you're promoting your book and probably, I don't know, maybe you just have the traveling spirit in you. But there are certain areas that we go to where we just feel some sort of energy. And a lot of times that energy is connected, strangely enough, to death. And I'm wondering if there's a kind of a connection between that sensitivity to that feeling, to that energy, to that spirit, and your poetry.
Absolutely. So East Meridian is a project that is born out of a sort of folk faith, the faith of my grandmothers, the faith of my tías. You know, their nurture and their care really made an impression on me when I was younger. They just had such a gentle, but I don't know, just like sure way of knowing others, knowing how to care for others. They knew the earth, they knew plants, they knew animals. They just understood things in a way that was like beyond my comprehension.
Right.
And they also had these rituals, you know, it, around like Christmas time, around Easter, you know, Dia de los Muertos. Like they just had this spiritual connection to the dead. And photographs, you know, were something that I grew up with as a kid. You know, I would feel very connected to an ancestor because I would hear stories about them. I would hear these sort of like legendary, you know, almost fairy tales about like, you know, their sort of magical presence and their histories. And so I think when you grow up sort of thinking of family as these like spiritual presences that are accessible through prayer and through ritual, that sort of bleeds into or becomes one sense of poetry.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I feel like, you know, the rosary appears in the cadences in a lot of the poems of Beast Meridian. I feel like, you know, the book itself functions like an altar because of the photographs that are in there that ask the reader to revere the dead. And that was part of the reason that I wanted those photographs in there. I feel like immigrants are invisible in a lot of ways. And so putting a photograph next to a poem, I'm asking the reader not just to see this person that is invisibilized for, you know, systemic, political, institutional reasons, but also to revere them like I revere them. And, you know, it's also elevating the family photo to the station of high art and high literature.
Yeah, that was a question that I was going to ask you about those family photos. So I'm glad that kind of came up on its own. But I wanted to ask you about this idea of, you know, being in touch with the dead. You have this beautiful line in the poem called Guadalupe, Star Horned Taurus. It begins with, that I commune with the dead as I oil your feet. And I love this image because, you know, to anoint one's feet is a tradition that has existed beyond our own history and goes really deeply into the human experience. And I'm wondering if in some ways when you write your poetry, do you find that the language or the images that you're writing about kind of connect you to more strongly to your grandmother, for example?
Yeah, the reality of living in the Rio Grande Valley and not having access to adequate medical care, health care, is that people tend to age very quickly and get sick very quickly. And so as a child and all throughout my adolescence, I grew up watching my family sort of care for each other. When my grandmother was dying of cancer, in addition to the limpias that my, you know, aunts and my grandmothers would do for her to relieve her spirit of whatever darkness was following her, they would also address the pain of her body with, you know, these oils. And some of it was just like over-the-counter kind of stuff, like, you know, Vicks Vaporub, right?
Right,
like,
right.
Very, very common in a Latino family household. But also some of it was just like, it seemed almost like potions, like, you know, like magic potions. They had this connection to these materials and these ways of relieving pain that seemed completely disconnected from anything having to do with medical care, hospitals.
Right.
And, you know, they would bring these materials into an institutional space, like a hospital, like, you know, velitas, like actual like candles and basil and all of this stuff. And it was this disruption in like that sanitized environment that made my grandmother feel safe and cared for. So, yeah, I mean, I think that line just came from almost like a soul memory, or like a psychic imprint, because it's something that I witnessed a lot and have witnessed and have also done myself. You know, now that my own father is falling ill, I have to care for him in certain ways. And, you know, that always falls on the eldest daughter, usually, right?
Right.
We become the caretakers at a very early age. And so I wanted to capture that, you know, the sort of caretaking that is spiritual, feminine. It has a mysticism about it.
Right, right. And I love the way that poem ends, that I have silenced the stones into a circle. First of all, I think that is just an amazing line. And that you arrived at that line just blows me away.
Thank you.
That I have silenced the stones into a circle, that they speak of failure, my daughters. And then you have a space and the next line is agony in the garden, and it's juxtaposed with the picture of, I assume that's your grandmother and maybe your mother standing in a garden.
Yeah, that is my Tia Lupe. She was also my godmother. I was baptized in Matamoros where she lived. And my great grandmother Carmelita, and her poem is near that photo as well. Mm. She's my great grandmother, and they're standing in this sort of lush garden in Matamoros, but behind a fountain that's like very close to my Tia Lupe's house. And what I love about that picture is that they're fading away. There was like something wrong with the camera. Either the lens was blurry or it just didn't focus quite right. And it just feels like such a haunted photo.
Yeah.
And I love that photo. And it reminds me so much of her house in Matamoros, because she had this absolutely wild garden, you know, behind the courtyard. You know, she had this big concrete sink, and, you know, she would bring these big sort of barrels of water and just do her thing back there.
Right. And you know, there's this kind of, I don't know how to explain it, but there's this light on one of the ladies, the one in the blue, it's this light going from her chin to her neck. You can't see the faces, you know, but you know the faces are there, but that light kind of gives her some sort of added energy. And then there's the fountain in the background that's rising up over them both, almost like a spirit or a ghost. It brings back that point you were making about taking family photos and turning them into art. This is just a beautiful image. Haunting.
Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, I feel their presence in that photo in the way that I described feeling it as a child. You know, like there would be pictures of my abuelito Aurelio, and I would feel his gaze on me, and not in a judgmental way, but just in a way that was like, I'm here, you know, I'm here with you. And that this photo, you know, I can tell they're smiling, and I can feel the transmission of that energy through the photograph.
They're giving energy to the page. There's no question about it.
In
fact, when I said earlier that I was going to ask you about the photos, one of the things that I was thinking about is, was it a struggle for you to get the publisher to include the photos, or did the publisher immediately understand that they belonged?
You know, that's interesting, because the photos were something that I added sort of last. When I was creating the book, I was writing two particular photos. And, you know, when I would workshop the poems, the photos would appear sometimes with the poem, because I just felt like bringing the poem without context, especially in an environment where no one shares my culture, no one shares my, you know, particular positionality, I felt like I needed something visual to anchor the work. And so I was talking to my editors and I was like, look, I just really feel like I need to include some photos. And they were like, okay, well, how many? And I said, like about 10. And they were like, oh, you know.
Yeah, yeah, because publishers, you know, aren't usually happy about doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because you either end up sacrificing quality if you just like a grayscale version.
Right.
Or, you know, you're asking the publisher to spend a significant amount of money, you know, to do full color. And so I told them, no, I don't really need full color. I just want the presence to sort of be invoked. And then, you know, I made that sort of argument about the significance of the photograph, the significance of you know, the work and the photograph working together inextricably to function as an altar. And I think that that argument, I was, you know, very fortunate to have two Latina editors, Susie Garcia and Carmen Jimenez-Smith. You know, they immediately understood what I was trying to do. It was present in the work already, and they just, you know, were like, okay, just let's put it together with the photographs and we'll see if it'll work. And, you know, when I got the box, I didn't expect the photographs to be there. And then when I opened them and I saw the full color,
yeah,
I was just so overcome
right.
with emotion, because I had not expected that at all.
I'm talking to Vanessa Angelica Villarreal, author of Beast Meridian, Poems, and a new collection. We're talking about these photos that you have. And what's really wonderful about the effect is that the color is muted, almost like a still shot from a Magruder film. I mean, it's got this history along to it. It just kind of, it really deepens, for me, the whole feeling of the experience. And reading your book is an incredibly emotional, spiritual experience. When you were here in El Paso, you read a poem about your grandmother, and people were in tears. They were in tears. Mostly the women were in tears. I mean, I would look around the place, I would see these women crying because of the poems. And it makes me wonder, like, when you are writing these poems, do you have an idea of who your reader is?
Yeah. So that was actually something that I kind of came up against in sort of pursuing my Master of Fine Arts. I was confused about who my audience was, because I always sort of wrote for myself and my family and anyone who could identify with the experience of being an immigrant, a first-generation immigrant, feeling sort of divided between two cultures. And so my work is about them, for them, about myself. Mm. I think I had to make certain mistakes in order to understand what I really wanted to do, because, you know, in experimentation, I wasn't necessarily writing to the subject matter that I was used to writing for.
Uh-huh.
I just grew frustrated with that, because I didn't want to write for an academic audience. I didn't want my poems to be inaccessible, but I did want them to have a sense of intentional craft, and not just for the sake of craft, but, you know, something that made sense for the poem, and that anyone could access picking up the book.
Absolutely. And that describes, I think, what's going on in this book very well. The language is amazing. I mean, you could just close your eyes and listen to the language, and it doesn't even matter at that point how the language is spread across the physical page, because you're just so engrossed in you know, the rhythms and the images that pop out, the prayers. I was reading this book in the morning, and our 9-year-old girl, who you met, she was one whose room you complimented so much, and I thought that was really a very beautiful gesture on your part to make such a big deal out of her room. But she came up and she sat on my arm. She goes, "What you doing?" And I go, I'm reading Vanessa's book, and I showed her the book, and I reminded her of who you were. And I was on reading Malinche, and she says, "Why is there a box in the middle of the poem?" And I says, "That's a really wonderful question, and I'm going to ask her that for you." But also, there's this larger question about how the poems appear across the page, because there are, you know, a huge variety of how the poems appear. And I'm wondering, as you're writing a poem, do you see it on the page, or do you write the poem and then later arrange it on the page? How do you know how it needs to appear?
That's a great question. Sometimes the language arrives first, which I credit, my dad for very much. He's, a musician, has been a musician all his life. And so the way language arrives to me is sometimes in a very, sonic way.
Uh-huh.
And also I did visual art for, a number of years. I abandoned it a couple of years ago, but I think that when I see a poem kind of arriving, I know what shape I want it to take. I feel like traditional lineated forms are wonderful to learn. They impart so much, like experimentation and what you can do with language. But for me, they just weren't working hard enough to convey what I wanted to convey. I just, had to come up with another way of arranging language on the page in order to give the reader another sense of what this language was doing. So like with Malinche, for instance, it opens the book because I think the figure of the Malinche especially is something that's almost taken for granted. It's a slur that's taken for granted, that's rooted in sexism, misogyny, and just a total, rewrite of history. For listeners who don't know who the Malinche is, she is considered the first trader. She is an indigenous woman who was Hernan Cortez's lover, concubine, and translator, and she aided him in the colonization of indigenous Mexico. Now, that is actually not what happened at all.
Right, right.
Sold by her family who saw these, rich colonizers, and she was sold into slavery. She had to translate for him. She did have a little bit of a Stockholm syndrome going on, but, when she had the opportunity to escape, she did, and then she disappeared forever. And so this poem is sort of the slur in poem form. And, it's the thing that surrounds the box that Latinas are kind of constrained by.
Right.
If you come to the United States and you do well and you get a house and you're successful, you're a Malinche because you left your family behind. If you marry, someone who is not Latino, you're a Malinche because you're a traitor to your race or your family or whatever. And if you don't do anything with your life, then you're a failure too. So there's just no way to escape the language and the legacy of the Malinche. And so, the box, which is the shape that the later poems will take, is the language that surrounds this box. The later poems will be echoes of that box.
Oh, that's a beautiful answer. And I'm going to try to relate that to her. What I kind of suggested was that, it kind of looks like a window, that box in the middle of Malinche. And it really, for me, was a window of opportunity to talk about Malinche to her. And I think that we have a new generation coming up that will consider Malinche, a strong figure rather than, the traditional interpretation of her. So basically the poem gave us a window into being able to speak about this to a 9-year-old. So thank you.
I've seen it sort of like as a window later, like as a frame, also as like a hole in the argument.
I like that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted it to have lots of different functions, but the main thing was to have this opening in the middle of the poem to sort of begin that journey.
Yeah. Well, I wish we had more time because, I didn't even scratch the surface of all I wanted to ask you about these beautiful poems, and some of the images are haunting. And I tell you, it's just such a pleasure to dive into this language. But unfortunately, we're running out of time, so maybe we could end with having you read one of the poems so our listeners can hear what's going on, at least get a glimpse of it.
Sure. Guadalupe, star-horned Taurus, that I commune with the dead as I oil your feet. My house at the throat of the river, the door to this world, I wait for you, that I ask of the Spirit and receive the knowledges. Yerbabuena, vela de virgen, baño de aluquema. Cut the joint at the hoof and fatten the soup. Accept this offering. Thank the plant. That I love you with the knowledge of our ways lost to violence. That you will call me up from the silt in your bones. On my final night on this earth, the smoke pours from my nostrils. I cut the cards, the melon in the moon, the rose climbing a ladder, thick coins in my cup, that my heart closes its fist, that my body succumbs to its constant nurture. What will you say in my memory? That my serenity, that my softness, that my skirt is the sky pattern, that the cedars kneel from my passage, that my laugh was kind, that your feet carry my body, that I am the helix the roses climb, that the illness spreads north as we cross, that these are the end days, that heaven groans blood, that I have scienced the stones into a circle, that they speak of failure. My daughters, agony in the garden.
That was Vanessa Angelica Villarreal reading from her new book of poems, Beast Meridian. Vanessa, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me. That was such a great and fun conversation. Thank you so much for reading so closely.
I love the book.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Vanessa Angelica Villarreal for joining us on Words on a Wire. Don't forget the name of the book. It is Beast Meridian Poems, and it's put out by Naomi Press. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Tarrazas, and I'd like to thank you, and we'll see you next time on Words on a Wire.